Welcome to CCC's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, March 29th, 2024. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Executive Editor, joins me today from New York City. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
The Association of American Publishers has published preliminary sales data for all of 2023.
That's right. This week, we learned that sales from the more than 1,200 publishers who report to the AAP StatShop program rose a little bit, very little bit, actually, 0.4%, this in 2023 over 2022, with the largest increase coming in the religious press category. As for adult trade, which is something we mostly concern ourselves with on this podcast, those numbers were basically flat. They were down just 0.3%. while sales in the children's and young adult segment fell 2.6%. And we should stress again that these are the AAP's preliminary figures, right? They're going to be adjusted. Usually sometime in the summer, we'll get the final numbers. But I think all in all, there's some good news to take away here, as the 2023 performance was a little better than expected, I think, except for children's, which is of growing concern, I might add. And most of all, I think that the post-pandemic sales slide appears to be arrested, suggesting that after a few years of record sales during the pandemic and then declines after the pandemic eased up a little bit, that books have finally found their equilibrium and at a level that is, you know, kind of leveled up a bit from where we would be if the pandemic hadn't happened. More good news from the digital audio sector in 2023, where sales jumped 16%. Ebook sales are back to normal, by which I mean down a little bit, small decline for ebook sales. But I really do think, going back to children's, that the main concern right now is that what's going on with children's publishing. The declines there are notable. And we talked about this a little earlier this year when Circana released its numbers. And there are fears in the industry that the pandemic shift to screens may be playing a role here with young readers. And I'm definitely hearing from people in the industry who are concerned about how the children's book publishing sector is going to rebound from this. So something to keep an eye on in 2024 for sure.
Penguin Random House, the world's largest English language trade publisher, reported sales climbed while profits fell in 2023.
Yeah, again, this is something we've been talking a little bit about on this podcast, and we've been seeing it in publisher reports that, you know, costs of inflation and supply chain challenges, all of this again, which I think publishers have actually done a great job dealing with. But it is a challenge. We're seeing this crop up. You know, remember for years that publishers would always say that, you know, flat is the new up. But recently, with the cost, the spike in costs and inflation, it's been more like up is the new down. And we can see that in Penguin Random House's numbers for 2023, where sales rose 7.3%, which is a healthy number. But worldwide, actually, revenue went up too. But profits actually fell very slightly, but nevertheless, they fell. In a letter to employees, Penguin Random House Global CEO Nihar Malavia acknowledged that 2023 was a difficult year for Penguin Random House in the U.S. It featured like a number of buyouts and an early retirement program and layoffs, and there were other corporate restructurings, all to deal with this cost issue. And while that was tough, those actions, Malavia wrote, have actually put the company on a solid footing. And he said he was very confident about the future, assuring employees that PRH had a very clear strategy in place for the publisher to move ahead and to thrive. Now, in addition to PRH, French conglomerate Lagardère released their revised full-year report for 2023, adding a little more detail to the financial results it had previously announced last month, and also seemingly tempering expectations for 2024. Notably, Lagardère raised the issue of AI in this report, characterizing the tech as a risk for the publishing business. I think that's something to keep an eye on too in 2024, because, you know, we're hearing a lot about the efficiencies and how wondrous this new AI technology can bring. But at the same time, publishers are still very much wary of it. And I think that this note appearing more and more in publisher financial statements, as it did for Lagardère, that says something, I think.
Simon & Schuster marks its centennial year in 2024, and Monday's PW, Andrew, covers the important book business milestone.
Yeah, it's a really fun and fascinating piece by Jim Milliot that kind of goes over the company's history. It was founded in 1924 by Richard Simon and Max Schuster. But as the company, you know, celebrates its 100th anniversary this year, they actually peg the founding to April. CEO Jonathan Karp said that, you know, there's been a lot of changes over that 100 years, but that the DNA of the company is still very much the same as it was back then, as an independent-minded publisher that has always taken a chance on authors and books. Now, in January, Simon & Schuster kicked off its centennial year with the release of the Simon & Schuster 100, a selection of 100 of the titles the company has published over its history. And as Karp suggests, what began with a windfall from these four best-selling puzzle books in 1924 very quickly, and quite impressively, I might add, expanded. Simon & Schuster's first full list, which was published later that year in 1924, would feature a biography of Joseph Pulitzer, for example, who was a hero of Schuster's. There was a poetry book, and there was a novel, the first novel that was published that year. Out of 241 submissions, they plucked one novel for its first inaugural full list. But a year later, in 1925, Simon & Schuster would publish a book that would be iconic, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. And in the following years, there would be heavyweights like Ernest Hemingway and Dale Carnegie. And in the 30s, Margaret Mitchell's epic Gone with the Wind. You know, in choosing a list of 100 books from 100 years of publishing, Karp said that, you know, the goal was to show, and I'll quote him here, the cultural sweep of Simon & Schuster's publishing program over the last 100 years. And it was no small task, he said, for a program that has yielded more than 60 Pulitzer Prize winners and almost 20 National Book Award winners. But what I love about the piece is Simon & Schuster's own story. While Richard Simon and Max Schuster were the main drivers in creating the company that bears their names a century later, there were a number of legendary publishing figures that played important roles in making SNS the 100-year success story that it is, and none more so than Leon Shimkin, which you might say is the silent partner, the silent third S in Simon & Schuster, one might say. Though he was just 17 at the time, Shimkin joined Simon & Schuster in its first year as a business manager, but he quickly became involved in virtually all of the publisher's major business decisions. And it was Shimkin, who was an early fan of Dale Carnegie, who convinced the motivational speaker to turn his lectures into How to Win Friends and Influence People, which Simon & Schuster released in 1936, and which has now gone on to sell more than 18 million copies and counting worldwide. You know, Shimkin also was a bit of a visionary. He worked with Robert Fair de Graaf to launch America's first paperback publisher, Pocket Books, in 1939. And among Pocket's achievements is the first instant book in American publishing history, which was a memorial to Franklin Delano Roosevelt that was published 6 days after the death of the president. You know, Shimkin would eventually go on to become the owner of Simon & Schuster. And there he began to lean heavily on a group of young executives, including Michael Korda and Dick Snyder. This until he sold the company to Gulf & Western in 1975. A move that kicked off Simon & Schuster's corporate era, which was wild, I will say. It was filled with expansion and acquisitions and then retrenchments closely thereafter. And ultimately, it all leads back to where Simon & Schuster is now after its acquisition by KKR, back sort of where Karp says it started 100 years ago as an independent publisher, although a very, very large independent publisher. Anyway, it's a great piece. I'm not going to spoil it for you here any more than I already have. It's a storied history behind Simon & Schuster, and you can read all about it in Monday's issue.
In the publisher-led lawsuit over the Internet Archive's scanning and lending of library books, the filing of amicus briefs is now complete.
Yeah, and we've rounded up all these briefs for our readers. You know, there were 6 amicus briefs submitted on behalf of a number of partners supporting the publishers. This is from a host of publishing and author groups and copyright associations, as well as, you know, copyright and IP scholars. These briefs were filed. They came on the docket at the end of last week after the publishers filed their opening appeal on March 15th. Internet Archive lawyers, meanwhile, filed their principal brief back in December, our readers might remember. And they have 11 amicus briefs that were filed in support of their case. Those were filed back in December, but we've been kind of waiting to share them all till we had both sides in here. And I have to say, those briefs represent the views of, you know, librarians and library associations, as you might expect, and authors and public advocacy groups. There's some law professors and IP scholars, too. But I will point out that some of the briefs in support of the Internet Archive are presented as neutral. The briefs, of course, are the latest development in this long-running copyright infringement case. It comes a year after Judge John G. Codal on March 24th, 2023, ruled that emphatically ruled that the Internet Archive's scanning and lending of library books was copyright infringement. And as for what comes next, the Internet Archive's brief, the reply brief, is due on April 19th. And then we're expected to have oral arguments in the case in the appeal sometime this fall. But I want to urge listeners to actually find some time to go back through the amicus briefs. You'll be giving you a bit of a guide here with our article at Publishers Weekly, because while I'm not sure how the legal case will go with the Court of Appeals, the broader issues laid out by the amici are really fascinating and something that, however the court decides in the legal case, is really going to require both sides in this case to come together on at some point to solve, I believe. So, I'm going to save further analysis about the briefs and about the case until we get to oral arguments before the appeals court. But again, I do think these amicus briefs are well worth your time if you're interested in the issues that are at the heart of this case.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly Executive Editor, thanks for joining me today with your reporting and editorial analysis.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on CCC's podcast, in surveys conducted in 2014 and 2020, hundreds of early career staff working in scholarly publishing disclosed surprising details about their career ambitions and the barriers they face to realize them. My CCC colleague Erin Foley and Rachel Moriarty of Oxford University Press shared with me the concerns of early career professionals.
I think in the future, there will be some real level of familiarity and proficiency needed for emerging AI tools. They need to be a little bit more aware of what's happening in the AI space, whether it seems like it touches publishing or not. It will eventually touch publishing, right? So I think there's going to need to be a lot more familiarity with AI and with AI tooling, depending on your job function especially.
And Rich Moriarty, what about the professional ambitions of early career people working in publishing?
So when we got the surveys back, in both surveys, we were looking at people who were based in the kind of science, technical, medical fields and HSS as well. They were still mostly within editorial departments working on books and journals. So a lot of the responses had that slant to it. We'd be working in editorial, production, marketing, and they were mostly wanting to figure out how did they progress within their current job. I know lots about mathematics, I know lots about social sciences, but I don't know about open access. I don't know about, different publishing models. So that was a lot of the information we got back in terms of what skills were they looking for that we could support.
Early career professionals in scholarly publishing tell all. Next on Velocity of Content. That's all for now. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to Velocity of Content wherever you go for podcasts and don't miss an episode of the show. The CCC podcast is also available on the CCC YouTube channel. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for joining me.